Well, good morning again, George Holford, retired, retarded, or whatever I am, chamber exec. I was here 17 years, and every night I have to remind myself of that. But we got a special show. That the topic is local matters, and we're on my job is Mondays, and I get the fun part every day. We have a different host. Ours is on, as you know, 8 a.m. on Mondays. And my job is to basically listen to stories of people in our region, our market, our community, who daily form the tapestry of our community and who make a difference and who live their lives. And I've told our guest today, I've never done a show that I didn't go away going, wow, I didn't know that. So today, I believe we've got a program that really fits the mission of this program. Pleased to have Captain Larry Cripps, retired from Smithville. And, man, we're going to go back. Some of you can't go back that far, but I know I can. We're going back to the Vietnam War, and we're going to talk about a lot of things at a time when our country was being challenged. Captain, welcome. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, George. It's great to be here. I appreciate this opportunity. Thanks for inviting me.
Good. I told you off air, we're going to do a Billy Graham thing, or most major religions try to answer three major questions. Who am I? Where did I come from? And where am I going? And I'm going to try to listen. It's going to be very hard. But let's start. And believe it or not, let's start at age birth. Talk about your formative years. Go on, you know, don't spend all time in high school, but just get on up to present day, and I'm gonna try to listen. But we're glad to have you here.
Thank you, George. Well, I grew up in a small farming community called Blue Springs in DeKalb County, about 10 miles south of Smithville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. That's where I grew up. And my parents were bivocational, as most people were during that time.
Of course.
Our neighbors were like extended members of our family. So mm-hmm. there were a lot of young people there. And we spent a lot of time together, you know, working on the farm, especially during the hay and tobacco seasons of summertime. You know, and so it was a great place to grow up. I learned so many things there. I learned about the world. You know, I matured emotionally and physically there mm-hmm. as farm boys tend to do, and it really laid the foundation unknowingly at that time, of course.
Sure.
Couldn't take the long view, but I just knew it was a great place to live. We had great neighbors, and that really became the foundation, really, of what I would do for the rest of my life.
Exactly.
Okay? And, yes. So, you know, I think I was about probably in my mid-30s when I began to realize what an advantage I have been around some of those people. Most of them were, you know, post-World War II veterans or had served during the World War in Korea and been around their stories. You know, Tennessee traditions and history were very much a part of my upbringing as anything else, you know. You know, the war between the states in particular, because so many battles were fought in that area, you know.
Yes,
Tennessee,
the borderlands.
More battles.
This
Civil
Tennessee,
War than
Kentucky.
Any,
yeah.
They did. Any other state, you know, in the United States outside of Virginia, you know. So I grew up with those stories and folklore and history, and they were very much a part of who I was, you know, and really, you know, formed my worldview, you could say.
Sure. You said something during the Civil War. The South had the farm boys and the people who could fire them. You know, the North was a lot of industry. Yeah. So we understood how to do things.
Right. And Tennessee was somewhat, you know, divided on secession. You know,
yes, we were.
We supplied as many troops probably for the South as we did for the North.
That's right.
And for example, my great grandfather and his older brother Thomas fought for the North and Field Tennessee Cavalry and were part of the Tennessee campaign, you know, and also Chickamauga, you know, Chattanooga, the battle in Chattanooga, mm-hmm. and Lookout Mountain.
Lookout Mountain, certainly.
That whole area took part in that. And my father remembered him. He lived to a good old
great.
Age.
That's great.
And but he, they, you know, there was a lot of that. You know, again, those incredible stories were part of my formation and my, you know, understanding of the world, and provide a good backdrop. You know,
and Sesquicentennial we had here at Tennessee Tech some years ago. And the stories and Chad, I think East Tennessee, Chad, really were never really seceded. They were Northern sympathizers, and it, but it was this was the borderland.
So East Tennessee, I mean, we were a border state. And that's
right.
We're
so the border.
Strategically important to both sides, and because of the major waterways that we have to the deeper South, so on and so forth. But that again, we were. You know,
brother against brother,
yeah.
family
yeah.
storm.
Family against family. But
so you have a heritage, a strong heritage in our community and region.
Well, I've
generations.
I've grown older, I've learned more about that, and you know, really begin to understand more about who I am and why, you know, I think the way I do,
sure.
what my sentiments are, you know, and my deep rooted values, where they came from, and that's important to know. I think it's important to share it with your children so they can better understand
that's right.
who they
the
are.
Oral
that's
history.
Right. That's right. That's what it's been.
So now we got you up. You're on, been on the farm, and then you're moving forward toward. You're in high school, and you're going. You know, whatever you. What you, we're right during the height of the Vietnam War. So I'm gonna be quiet and let you pick up there.
Well, I entered high school in the fall of 1963.
Yep.
And I have a brother who was 4 years older than me. He had graduated in the spring of 1963, and at that time, you know, the Vietnam War was really didn't make the evening news. We were there in advisory
that's
capacity.
That's right.
You know, but later on, but what was foremost at that time was the Civil Rights Movement.
That's right.
So I came of age against the backdrop of the Civil Rights Movement, then the Vietnam War, and then the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s and 1970s.
Yep.
Okay. So, again, that was a very, you know, tumultuous time and a very divisive time for our nation, you know. But you know, I was all part of that.
That's right.
And that really, you know, years later, you know, that formed the foundation, you know, of the book that I've recently
I was going to say, you're an author.
Yeah.
And we're going to get into that in just a moment.
Yeah.
So you were part of the Vietnam era, and you mentioned the civil rights movement, the cultural people today, young people today think this is unique, the things that we go through. This is who we are as country. We've had some other things happen over the 250 plus years, longer than that. So,
well, for a small town country boy, you know, I didn't, you know, there were not a lot of African Americans in our community.
No, there weren't.
And those that lived there were, you know, in a certain part of town. So I didn't have much interaction with them.
Okay? That's right.
And the schools, again, then were, you know, that most of the children attended school in Lebanon, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and desegregation had not happened at that time.
That's right. This was pre.
Right, but watching this, you know, the civil rights movement unfold, you know, on evening TV. We didn't have a TV until the 1960s.
Oh yeah.
And then, you know, my parents watched the evening news.
Walter Cronkite.
You know, and so I'm seeing all this unfold, and I'm wondering what it all means.
That's okay? right. That's so, exactly right.
So, you know, it was quite an interesting, you know, piquing my interest and causing me to question some of my some of the things that I held very closely, you know, and it was a interesting time where, again, you were pushing the envelope, you know, you had all these emotions that you didn't understand, you know, you were seeing all these things play out on the evening news, and you wasn't sure what it all meant, you know. But eventually, obviously, we would come to terms with that. You know?
Yes. I blew this earlier. You've written four books.
Yeah.
You have a current book out, which is what we're already talking about, the Hope.
It's called The Hope of War.
The Hope of War. So we're going to get into that a little bit. And we got a little time left in the first segment. But let's get you on through. You got through high school. You got drafted, is
I
that
did.
Correct?
I
so
did.
let's just pick up there and let's talk about
well, it again,
what formed another era in your life.
Yeah, America's involvement in Vietnam began to really accelerate, obviously, beginning in 1965.
That's right.
And then, you know, the classmates I had gone to school with at DeKalb County High School,
yep.
you know, played football with, and, you know, most of my friends were about two years ahead of me in,
yep.
in school.
So you were watching what was coming for you later.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so I was watching, you know, these, after we graduated, I graduated in 1967. Like I said, they were a couple of years ahead of me. And the Vietnam War was capturing these people almost by year group.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
And so I had friends that had graduated in 1966, and they were drafted and, you know, left for the military service and eventually wound up in Vietnam within a few short months of their induction. And so that was kind of the sequence.
Yeah.
Eventually, you know, it came to my year group, and I received my draft notice in the spring of 1969. Okay.
Just
and
keep
I was
rolling,
I was building a house at that point, so they gave me a little delay so to finish that house.
Okay.
And I finished that house, and then I entered the Army in August of 1969 and took basic training at Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Fort Campbell, yes, 101st,
101st.
History. Again, I'm going back now, but you're a person of faith, and we're going to really get into that. And we've been accused this is a faith-based show, people sharing their faith. So somewhere along the way, you and your family, you embraced, and part of that was when you went to – before you already were a Christian and been in church.
I was raised in a
Christian family.
During my high school years, you know, I began to really drift away from that foundation. And but by 1969, I gave my heart to the Lord, and then that, again – changed everything for me, and within a few months I was in had boots on the ground in Vietnam.
And we're going to talk chaplain, and we're going to talk a lot of good things coming up. George Hofford with Captain Larry Cripps retired. Back soon. What a rich start! What a rich story! We can't do this, Larry, in 30 minutes, but we'll do our best. Now we've got you drafted. You're drafted. You're going to the service. You've got a great family background, like the Waltons.
Yeah,
that's where we grew up.
You could compare it to, yeah. You could do that.
We had family and we had friends, and you talked about that tumultuous time with civil rights and Martin Luther King, but anyway, just a lot of good stories. So let's pick up there, and I'm going to be quiet. So,
well, you know, I was 18 years old when I was drafted, and then I. You know, and within a few short months, I had boots on the ground in Vietnam. And,
wow.
And when I arrived there in early 1970, my unit that I was assigned to was with the 2nd Squadron, the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, and they worked with the 1st Air Cav, the 1st Infantry Division, the 23rd Infantry Division, so on and so forth. And we worked as a combined force, you know, with the South Vietnamese Army. But they were spearheading. My squadron was spearheading the operation into Cambodia at that time.
Ooh,
you know,
okay,
and of
sure.
course, you know, Richard Nixon had approved. We were going after this sanctuary bases, the North Vietnamese sanctuary bases across the border, which had always been a thorn in our side. You know, and so we were operating in the largest area of South Vietnam, Third Corps. Okay, and it was more suited for armor units than north of there, like in 2nd and 1st Corps.
Then boots on the ground, it was armored.
Yeah. So, but you know, it was a fast-paced time. I got there, and my first exposure, you know, was to the reality of the fact that, hey, this is for real.
Yeah.
I came in country.
This isn't Walter Cronkite anymore.
I was assigned to my unit, and, you know, and then within a week after I'd gone through an orientation course – to get us acclimated to what we might, you know, to expect, you know, to hopefully enhance our survivability, then I was thrown right into the mix of what was going on. And again, it was the operation into Cambodia at that time.
You know, a thought just popped up. You're probably like a lot of us. You probably did not travel a lot as a child. You grew up on a farm. You didn't
outside the state.
So that's what I'm just saying. All of a sudden,
Pigeon Forge, you know, and
that was big. I mean, just
East
to go
Tennessee.
A couple hundred miles from home.
It was.
And now you're on a plane or you're on a ship, and next thing you know, you're all the way across the world.
Eighteen years old.
How did that feel?
Just riding the bus from Benoit Air Base is where we landed and disembarked there, and we put on buses, and we took about a 15-20 minute ride to what was called the 90th Replacement Center, and so that's where people would stage, and then they would issue the orders to the unit that you were going to after you arrived in country, you know, so that. That bus ride from the airport to the 90th Replacement Center was a real eye-opener for me. I didn't realize that people lived in shacks. And the traffic
was
chaotic.
You lived on a farm in rural Tennessee.
Well, it was a different world. The smells were different. You know, the environment, the view was different. You know, obviously it was for, you know, a small-town country boy. It was quite a cultural shock, you know,
for me. Didn't go through a big orientation.
There was no orientation.
Pre-orientation.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, you're in Vietnam.
No. The only thing people who served in Vietnam who had come back before I left.
Would tell stories
and try to prepare me for
But nothing could really prepare you for the real
thing.
You're there. Let's pick it up there. Talk about experiences.
Well, after I reported to my unit, you know, they were bringing the wounded and those who had been killed in action, you know, out of the field. And we were at a place called Quan Loi. It had a large airstrip there. It was part of an old French plantation.
Okay.
And so we had a large base camp there. It was a logistical base. And so we were, our armor unit consumed a lot of logistics, you know, fuel, you know, ammunition, food, whatever they needed, you know, to keep them operating, you know. And so, that was my first experience and where I realized this is for real and I might not go home the way I went over there.
That's right.
And so because I was a person of faith, I prayed and I said, Lord, all the concern I have is for my family, how it might impact
them. That's right.
I'd had three friends who had been killed in Vietnam before I went. I had an uncle who was a helicopter pilot who on his second tour was killed in action during the Tet Offensive in 1968.
Why them and not me?
We were just, even at a young age, at 18, I'd already been exposed to a lot of grief.
That's right.
High school, my classmates who I'd spent a lot of time with, an uncle who was more like an older brother to me than anything else, and an uncle, we were that close, you know, and I really idolized him. And we, you know, and we, that was, my family had always served in the military, and I had two uncles that had been at Normandy on D-Day.
Served
in the Pacific on the USS Intrepid, the most frequently hit, you know, ship and aircraft carrier, and Bill Hawes's Third Fleet, and my father had survived that, you know. But here we are, you know. So we with all that background, you know, again when you're there and you're faced with those challenges yourself, it's a whole different ballgame.
So you were well prepared but not prepared. How did you become a chaplain?
After I came back after I finished my tour and I came home in the spring of 1971, I entered Lee University up in East Tennessee.
Sure.
Now, you were not
a chap, obviously. You were just over there.
No, I was
not
a draftee.
Just over there, but
soldier.
You were a draftee.
Yeah.
Later on, you felt called.
Well, it was not until I was a senior in college up at Lee University.
Lee University,
it was called
sure.
Lee College then.
Tennessee.
Lee University now. But that, you know, people begin to, you know, recruiters would come to the campus, and they would talk to students, and they were interested in trying to recruit people to become officers in the various branches.
You came home and re-enlisted.
I really didn't. I didn't have plans to go back on active duty, but just that talking with people, and people would come up and say, you know, Cripps, you would make a good chaplain, military chaplain. And I'm not sure if it was the haircut or what, okay? But I'm not sure exactly what made them
think
that.
But God was calling you to this. You were having a call, a special time.
Yeah, well, I went to a conference in between my junior and senior year, a church conference over in Chattanooga. And there was an Army chaplain there, and he spoke of two experiences that he had And from that, you know, the Lord really began to deal with me about the calling to become a chaplain. And so that was the genesis of that.
How it started.
And how it started. And so I had actually intended to return to the Army as an Army chaplain. But during the post-Vietnam years, the Army was really drawing down.
Yes.
But in 1980, after I had finished seminary under President Ronald Reagan, the Navy was recruiting extensively. They were going to build a 600-fleet Navy. And so the Navy reached out and said, would you be interested in becoming a chaplain in the Navy? And so that's how it all started. That's how I spent the next 32 years in the Navy as a Navy chaplain.
Well, we got about a minute on this segment, but I'm excited about now your book and your books and how you became an author and your chaplain and experiences that you had as a man of God on steroids, going to another level. But also experiences you had and what that meant, and then what are you doing? And then today, what are you doing today? We'll look in the future. But man, this is I'm intrigued. I'll just tell you, I'm a revisitor. So we got about 30 seconds left. So what? Anything else from that era that you want to that jumps out at you?
Well, you know, I didn't realize how my experience in Vietnam would prepare me for what I did as a Navy chaplain. I spent two-thirds of my 32 years as a Navy chaplain serving with the Marine Corps, okay? And I served in the first Gulf War in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. Then I was one of the senior watch officers at the Pentagon.
Hold right there, and we're going to take a quick break. I want you to pick up right there. When you get back, we'll go. George Alford, Captain Larry Cripps, retired. Telling a story. We'll be right back. Well, we're back. We've Captain Larry Cripps, retired chaplain from Smithfield, Tennessee, grew up like the Waltons, got drafted in Vietnam War. He's home now, went to Lee University, and now we're going to talk about the two-thirds, I believe, of your life and then where you're going in just 9 minutes. But let's pick up where you left off and just talk about how you got the chaplain and what some of your key experiences doing that and then looking in the future.
Well, like I said, my plans were actually to return to active duty as an Army chaplain, but the Army was drawing down during Vietnam years. The Navy reached out and said, would you be interested in becoming a Navy chaplain? We're recruiting extensively, life would consider coming over here. And my brother had served in the Navy. My father had served in the Navy during World War II.
That was a natural.
And so I talked to my dad. He said, I would encourage you not to wait, but to go ahead, you know, and I never looked back. So I made that decision. And, one of the best jobs I ever had, probably one of the best decisions I ever made.
Oh, yeah.
Just a lot of unique opportunities that I had that I couldn't have orchestrated if I had tried.
No.
You know, but my, you know, my background having served in Vietnam, you know, gave me an advantage in that I had that experience.
Your maturity.
It did. I was a combat veteran when I came back before I was 21 years of age. You see what I'm saying? So
yes.
So I had those ribbons and people were intrigued by that. And then
it gave you an entree.
It was a bridge for conversations, you know. And there were a lot of Vietnam veterans that were left over at that time. And I had a wonderful, wonderful mentors of Navy chaplains that had served with the Marine Corps in Vietnam. So we had that connection.
You had a bridge there.
We did. And so there are a lot of great conversations, but it led to, you know, a wonderful opportunity for ministry. I just, again, it was unlimited what I could do. And I enjoyed being with the sailors aboard ships, you know, being with Marines, you know, on the ground, you know, and doing ministry, you know, on the fly sometimes, you know, doing ministry back in garrison or back in port. Or doing it on the fly, you know, just like I had seen it done in Vietnam, you know, when I served there.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just a really, you know, for a person who was, I was physically strong and motivated, you know, just really enjoyed what I was doing. You know, once I realized that God was calling me to be a chaplain, I never looked back, and I committed my whole heart to it.
That's great.
And
that's great.
You know, my first experience, as a combat chaplain came during the first Gulf War, during Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and I was assigned to a CB battalion then, and who were working for the Marines, okay, for the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force. And those guys were scattered everywhere, just doing some incredible work,
Facilitating
what the Marines were doing and improving their quality of life and ensuring that they had roads, you know, to get their supplies where they needed to be, so on and so forth. But it was an incredible ministry. I was all over that desert, you know, preaching several times a day. And
yes.
Would come back to the base camp on the weekend and preach on two services on Sunday, one in the morning, one in the evening.
Wow.
So that really shaped my concept. I'd had an Army chaplain in Vietnam who really impressed me what combat chaplains should be, ministry should be. And I just had a chance during the first Gulf War to build on that, flesh it out in my own mind, in my own experience. And it was a wonderful experience. Later, you know, I served as one of the senior watch officers the morning after the 9/11 attack on the Pentagon.
Oh, my God.
There were 10 of us who were initially sent there, and our role was to coordinate support for at the crash site itself for the search and rescue efforts to support the families of the ones who had been killed or were missing. It was a recovery effort for that first week, and then a search and rescue effort, and then it turned into a recovery effort after that first several days when we realized there was no hope of anyone else surviving. And that really had that experience triggered a lot of experiences or emotions I had left over Vietnam that I had repressed for a number of years. When I came back, and I too went through when I was in college my first semester. And had no, you know, preparation for what the transition would be like. Didn't have any indication.
You know, post-traumatic stress syndrome is for real.
It's absolutely real.
But it's real.
And that really was the, you know, after I retired, one of the motivations I had for writing my book, The Hope of War, A Chaplain's Journey to Abiding Faith, Enduring Hope, and Love Under Fire. You can purchase that, you know, on Amazon. Or you can buy it direct on my website, which is www.thehopeofwar.com, and it will take you to my website, and you can save about $10 by buying it direct.
Repeat that for the audience, because we have a strong veterans group in our region, as you know, Tennessee, and there's people who will want to buy your book and would need your book.
Well, you can purchase the book. You can find it on Amazon. But like Amazon. I said, you can go to my website, which is the www.thehopeofwar.com, and just scroll down the website, and you can see you can buy, you know, the hard copy or the paperback copy, whichever you prefer. And you can also buy a Kindle, you know, version of that as well. And I hope people will reach out there. It's especially for young people, for combat veterans, for people serving today, for their families, for first responders.
Well, I think it sounds like
it is. And it's a story, you know, it talks about the people and place where I grew up. That's how it begins. And then it gradually moves into the struggles of a young man coming of age against the backdrop of what I've already mentioned, you know, the Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War.
Oh, you cover
and
eras.
The Cultural Revolution and how that really shaped, you know, my experiences, and then my wartime experiences of confronting the trauma and the grief of that, and coming back and making the transition from the Army to safety and routine of everyday life. And it was a struggle that first year, but it was from those struggles that I realized that the impact of the trauma of war. People experience all kinds of trauma and experiences and setbacks. This book is just not for veterans or service members and their families, for anyone who has gone through a difficult challenge or experience or a setback. It provides a faith-based model. It provides themes that drives each chapter that are biblically based. And so, you know, the feedback I've gotten that it has been extremely helpful to people and an eye-opener. You know,
so that's what led you over a career and a lifetime. You evolved to where
I did.
God wants me to put this in a book.
I don't consider myself to be a writer, you know. But when I started thinking about years ago about what people were experiencing, we were losing veterans from our most recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, about 22 a day, and also what young people were going through, the fact that they really don't understand much about American history.
We
got to where we are.
That's right.
You know, I wrote the book to encourage them to think critically and deeply, to do the research. It's hard and takes time, but that's find out who we are as a nation and as a people, you know, and what are our real, you know, our traditional values and how deep-rooted they've been and make us the nation and the people that we are.
You know, there's nothing new under the sun.
Nothing new.
And I mentioned earlier, we've got a generation and people who who are going through some the Vietnam War, the cultural issues, the civil rights, the pendulum swings.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, I'm not talking politics, but everything is, sooner or later, it had to swing.
Well,
and sooner or later, it swings back. And most of us are in the middle, aren't we? We're moderates.
Well, you know, a lot of the things that we see happening in our culture and society today really are a spinoff from the 1960s and 70s.
Yes, they are.
Okay? And I know that, you know, when I came back from the war, things were changing, you know. Probably, you know, from what it had been before I left, I was drafted, and that's when the Jesus Revolution took place.
Yes,
out in Southern California, and it spread, you know, to Asbury University, so on and so forth, and I was fortunate that during those post-war years, you know, I saw the impact of that revival on veterans and on activists and all kinds of things. The Lord just did all kinds of wonderful things during that period.
But they had long hair and they wore jeans and they did a little. No, but it was a movement a lot of people didn't realize was happening.
That's right. It's right. It was a very important time in our
history. Our lives. Yeah. And I forgot the minister of Netflix. They had a thing about the California, the Jesus.
Yeah, talking about Chuck Smith.
Yeah, yeah. The Jesus movement.
Yeah, the Jesus movement.
Can you imagine?
Well, when I was stationed out in California for my first assignment, his church was just right up the road from San Diego, and there were a lot of people that I was stationed with that attended his church. He just had a tremendous impact.
And, can you imagine traditional conservative, button down, wear a suit, sport coat and tie every Sunday? And all these people are showing up, and they're children of God, but they worship a little. They travel to the beat of a different drum.
They did.
It was a wonderful time, looking back.
You know, it really the revival that was sparked during that period of time, and it gave us a reprieve. You know, but like I said, a lot of the issues that young people have struggled with, and we've all struggled with as a nation here, in the past, 25 years. More specifically, you know, was it really a spinoff from the 1960s and 70s? You know, and so you know, there are always lingering impacts. You know,
well, I was going to ask you. And I know I just wondered where I hate this thing's begin to wind down. We got a little over a minute and a half left. What are you doing today? How are you serving? I know you're writing a book and you've written a book, but what do you look in the crystal ball? What do you see?
Well, we're using this book to raise money for two organizations. And
okay, that's great.
The Mighty Oaks Foundation, which continues the ministry that I did the last 10 years of my time on active duty, you know, preparing warriors to go into combat and to help them transition once they come back from their post-combat experiences. And also the Wounded Warrior Project. So those two organizations, we're using the book. We're holding events where they're patriotic events, and we invite the community to come. And obviously the book is offered, but the proceeds go to those two organizations.
Wow. We may have to talk about a future show because you've got so much the richness. God is God's not through with you yet, my friend.
He's not through with
any of us. That's right. So
we're to stay engaged until he calls us home.
A grateful host thanks you, and I'm sure our audience
does,
for taking us back through some times we haven't thought about. And I have goosebumps right now. Thank you.
Oh, God bless you, my friend.
God bless you. Folks, we're out of time, unfortunately. Captain Larry Cripps, retired author, Smithville, and – stay tuned. Next time, we'll go again. Bye-bye.